Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer Distributors. For more information, visit unionbeerdist.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's October 3rd, 2017. It feels like October in New York. It's a little chilly out.
Yeah.
We're wearing our sweaters. Dan Pucci, Lauren Wilson, welcome to the show, guys. We're here on Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network, and we're talking about the upcoming Cider Week NYC. Big shout out to our sponsor, Union Beer Distributors, supplier of world-class ales and ciders. All right. So Lauren Wilson, Dan Pucci, Cider Week New York's coming up. It feels like cider. It's kind of crisp in the air.
You know? Definitely.
And just tell us about, you know, we know your background, Dan. You're the pommelier. You've been on a few times. But Lauren, it's going to be kind of your show today because I didn't know how much you're into cider. I know you're on the board of Slow Food NYC. You're an editor for Edible Brooklyn Manhattan.
Yeah.
But you wrote a great article recently about a Normandy ciders. And you tell us how you got interested in cider. And I know you've got a story, backstory with Dan.
Dan has been very helpful for a long time for me as a source for stories and also just general education. My initial interest in cider actually started when I moved to New York and started this job with Edible. I'm from the Southeast. I grew up in Western North Carolina, which is an apple-producing region for sure, but nothing like I had ever kind of encountered in New York. And so about 4 or 5 years ago, I kind of saw the stirring of what seemed to me had been happening at one point with beer and was excited about the experimentation and decided to follow it as best I could from afar while trying to follow everything else in New York City. And Dan inevitably has been involved with that. So in any case, recently this article I wrote about Normandy came out of, I went to an event at Wassail that was over, well,
it's probably last fall or early winter.
It was January. So it was like, 10 months, 9 months ago.
Yeah, 10 months ago.
Yeah. Which, there was a French cider maker who was coming to speak in the back room there. And, you know, there was programming series there. And I used to live in France, too. I was there for about 4 years. And just curious about how French cider's perceived, what it is generally as compared to what's being done in the U.S., Spain, other regions, et cetera. So I just kind of went with an open mind to learn. And went in, the room was full of tons of professionals who had come from very far away to hear. His name is Jérôme Dupont, and so he has Domaine Dupont, which is in Normandy, his techniques, his cider making. And I learned that actually he is kind of a French cider maker who's, or his father is kind of at the genesis of Cider Week, coincidentally. So maybe Dan, you can speak to that, right? There was an exchange at
there was
some
an
point.
Exchange years ago with Glenwood, which is an organization based in Cold Spring, about an exchange about bringing cider makers from France.
Maybe like here. 2010.
Yeah, 2010 or so, 2011. Yeah. Bringing cider makers from France here to the United States and showing what we have here, and then American producers in the Northeast and New York State going back to France and kind of learning from their techniques and learning their understanding of how their culture and their cider making things are there. And we have a lot of producers here who are still, those relationships are still in place, and people still go back on a pretty regular basis to go learn and explore and kind of get a better understanding of what cider is in that context versus what is here in this context here in the United States.
Can you name any of those producers
who went?
Or I know like some of the ones who went, but maybe have ongoing relationships.
I know Elizabeth Ryan for sure goes back pretty regularly. I think she's usually there once a year or so.
And she is,
she's Breezy Hill Breezy Orchards, Hill, which is like Hudson Valley Farmhouse. She goes back pretty frequently, I believe. She's probably the most of anybody. I know like Dan at Slyboro also, I think, goes over occasionally as well. And kind of like yeah, kind of learning about cider making there from that perspective. And I know it's another big trip. The Northwest did a big exchange this year as well, where a bunch of Northwest producers up in Washington, Oregon, British Columbia all went to France to kind of like learn about keeving and learn about their process and how do they can improve their cider making in the Northwest by learning from the French.
I think that's a great, you know, the impetus for Cider Week was about all the great apples in New York and trying to make value-added product. I always love the connection with the great, you know, cider-producing regions of the world, whether it's in Spain, England, and France. And I remember when, you know, American wine was starting out in the 70s, you know, the California wineries, you had a taste and you had to compete against, you know, the top Bordeaux in France. And you can't live in a bubble. So I think it's a smart thing, and I that's why you got on the show, because you wrote about Normandy ciders, and I think everyone really should taste, you know, the best ciders in the world.
Yeah, Normandy ciders are so very different than we have here, and they're so very special and so very unique compared to what we make here in the United States. There's very few people here in the United States who make anything remotely similar to what those ciders they make there.
And also what the angle of the article eventually took was, I think that being able to go to a destination, an old world destination, to taste ciders, you have the privilege of tasting like centuries long tradition in the way that we just can't in the United States because it's so young and because of prohibition. So you have the privilege of being able to go in a relatively short space, and it's relatively cheap, I would say. I could break that down a bit more to put it into perspective, especially with wine tourism. It's much cheaper than that. But you can, you know, see traditions that are 300, 400 years old, get up close with those producers, and then see people who are kind of taking that and turning it on its head to do something very new and innovative.
Dan, have you taken any cider trips around the world?
I was in Spain a couple years ago, but that's the only one I've ever
been. So most of your education was at
Wassail. All domestic, yeah.
So you had, let's just recap Wassail. When it opened, I remember suddenly
you had 2015
cider makers coming every week.
Yeah, we had people there every week.
We did a lot of shows with those cider makers.
Yeah, we were dragging folks down from all over the country to get them to New York and drink cider. For a long time, we had somebody there at least once a week talking, promoting, and kind of educating our staff there. I got talking to them, and the staff there got the best education possible, just like talking to producers and kind of getting an understanding of their perspective and where they're coming from in their everyday life and what they think about their products and how they talk about their products and things like that. And that's kind of the best education you can ever possibly get in the cider world.
And for now, like the trends, I mean, it seems that there's so many, you know, multi-generational New York family farms that are now, they used to do what? Pick your own apples.
Yeah,
now they're getting into
and cider donuts and things like that. Yeah, and like part of the original idea of Glenwood's Operation Cider Week was to like promote these ciders as a value-added product. It's about making some of the bounty of New York State profitable again, because New York State, like before real cider came along, like apple prices in New York State were pretty low, and these farmers were closing because it was not economical to really grow apples anymore. Like Mott's, who's based out in Wayne County, was like, they're the big buyer of apples in New York State, and they, like, economically it wasn't making sense for these guys to like grow fruit for Mott anymore because it wasn't making any money for them. Like, they're actually losing money picking apples, which is nuts. So the idea of Cider Week was to, in the idea of cider growth in New York State, was to kind of give these apples a home, and to kind of give them a spot where they can hopefully make a product that people can actually make money on.
And part of our show today, we're going to taste a lot of different ciders. And just tell us about the first one that you brought. It's pretty awesome. Or did you bring
it? I didn't bring this one. I think Justin brought this. But you could probably speak to like how this compares to the Angry Orchard portfolio, right?
Yeah, so this is Angry Orchard's first floor Ovo Novello, or Forest Valley floor Ovo Novello, which is, I think this is the new vintage. This is Ryan Burke's brainchild up in Walden, New York. This is all part of their like innovation line. Made from all apples. This is probably mostly most of the ciders are blends of Finger Lake high acid varieties like Northern Spies, and then blended with Steve Wood juice, which is gonna be like Harry Master Jerseys and Dabinet and things like that up in Farnham Hill. So it's usually
Justin,
a blend.
You got to bring that bottle back in.
So it's usually it's a blend of those
that
things.
That one went fast.
And the Ovo Novello is made. He has these giant fooders, and this is made in those giant fooders, these giant barrels, which are pretty amazing. Everyone who hasn't been up to the new Walden thing should definitely go. It's a pretty amazing spot.
It's really accessible, too, for tourists.
And do a large volume.
Do they sell cider? Or
they sell
the cider.
Innovation
Lab.
They do sell cider retail at the place there. Like they sell this retail mm-hmm. at the place there, and they do get it out there.
But where could I buy this? I mean, I'm just Angry Orchard. You know, you see it in every supermarket. But this is, you know, for people who can't see it, which is everybody listening. You know, it's a beautiful
packaging. Great stuff.
Yeah, it's like a champagne-esque bottle that's mm-hmm. got like a wax cap on it. Where would I get this?
I honestly don't have an answer for you right now. They do sell it, but honestly,
because I would buy this again.
Yeah, it's so good. It has like as much texture to it, and the acid's awesome. It's a really complex, delicious cider.
I think you have to go to fancy cider events. Fancy like cider. I'm produced to talk about Cider Week events. My event this year is Cider Feast. Mm-hmm. It's October 28th at Brooklyn Kitchen in Williamsburg. And Angry Orchard will be there. Eden will be there. Quite a nice lineup of cider makers. So they'll probably have some of these type of bottles.
Yeah, they have the new like Angry Orchard Eden collaborations. The new Angry Orchard.
They've done a Easy collaboration Orchard ones. Together.
Yeah, the Angry Orchard. They did them two so far, which is the they're called Understood in Motion series, and one's of Eden, and the second one's of Easy Orchards in Oregon.
Hmm.
And they're like, I had the Easy Orchard ones back in April or so or May when they're still like not quite fermented yet, and they were really awesome. And it's really Ryan was telling working with his, that was all juice pressed out in Oregon from Easy Orchards versus the juice you worked with was just Steve Wood juice. So similar varieties from very different growing spots, and the juice behaves very differently in the center of the menu. It was very very different.
So Dan, now that you're not at Wasail, you're a consultant, but are you going to these different cider makers?
Yeah, I'm going to producers.
Hanging out?
Yeah, I'm going to producers pretty regularly and hanging out and learning and kind of perfecting the craft of cider and kind of learning more about it and kind of hopefully applying that to other things and helping them succeed better. Like this spring, I hope open Alex Wilson and Irene Hussey at Wayside. We did their awesome new cider tasting room up in Andy's, New York, which is really awesome. So we built that out this spring. We have a couple other things going on. We have a big festival happening this weekend up at Scribner's Catskill Lodge. It's this weekend from Saturday and Sunday, from noon till 6 p.m. It's $35 for tickets to get in and $40 at the door. And it's going to run this giant pork roast. We're doing this giant porchetta thing as well. We have about like 10 or so producers coming with about 30 different ciders. It's going to be a lot of cider to drink. A lot of pork to eat, and it should be really, really awesome for a great 2-day festival.
Are you working with anyone in the city, by the way, in terms of beverage consulting?
Beverage consulting? Yeah, I work with Gristmill right now, which is in Park Slope on Fifth Avenue, First Street. We're kind of like rebuilding their beverage program a little bit right now and kind of.
That's exciting. I really like them.
Yeah, they're super nice. I've known Jake since. I've been here for about 5 years now.
Cool.
At previous places.
I was going to ask you where we could get the Angry Orchard special bottling. You know, what are the good places to get cider? I usually look to the Cider Week list of establishments.
Yeah.
But sometimes I'm at a loss. Like, where can I get a good cider in the city?
Mm-hmm.
It's hard. There's not enough places that sell enough cider with like regularity. Like, obviously, Stevens Bar, like, all like Cardiff Giant and Owl Farm and Great Barker Harry, they all support cider like crazy. Like the amount of cider that Cardiff Giant sells is kind of crazy. Like he was like, I can't believe how much cider we sell. And it's like, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
Steven's a huge cider fan and it's amazing how much cider they sell there. A couple places like up in Hell's Kitchen, As Is, which is in Hell's Kitchen on 10th Avenue, is a surprisingly a huge cider bar as well.
I would never have thought
it's mostly because of Seth Jones, who owns East Hollow Cider. He's like lives next door and he owns this amazing orchard up in Petersburg, and he just like that's his regular bar. He goes there every single time, and he's doing an event there tomorrow night, and he just like he's like good friends with them, so he's like, sell my cider, and he sells their cider, and he sells other ciders too.
That's good to know for destination.
I know, it's awesome. And where do you like to get cider? Is there a place near you?
Actually, there's a couple surprising sources I've found for cider in the city without ever having asked Dan. Shockingly, one time I was on specifically for Normandy ciders, I was surprised to find Eric Bordelais' stuff on Food Kick, which is like Fresh Direct's like direct delivery service that you can get in your house in like an hour. And I was like, what? I can get his Perry's and stuff on demand. True. Covenhoven near me has a decent selection. I would say, I mean, it's definitely not as broad as their beer. And June Wine Bar here and there will have some. But again, as Dan said, it's a little inconsistent across the board.
Yeah.
That's great, man. We got off to a great start here. Cider Week Preview. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
In 1996, Sheehan Family Companies, formerly L. Knife & Son, acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn. Union Beer has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. It has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Brooklyn and parts of Queens through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, Staten Island, and Long Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education at all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the seven counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit unionbeerdist.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey guys, it's Cider Week Preview. Hi, Lauren.
Hi.
Buddy, say your name, buddy.
Say my name again?
Yeah.
Lauren Wilson, editor of Edible Manhattan and Edible Brooklyn.
Awesome.
I'm Dan Pucci, cider person, I guess.
Wall about hospitality.
Yep.
As you're frequently referred to, a pommelier.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Is it not cider pommelier, it's pommelier.
Yeah.
Sure.
So we tasted this Black Duck Perry and you just...
Yeah, like, holy crap. This is the 2016 Black Duck Perry that I haven't tasted the cider yet. It is tannic. It is way more tannic than the cider's been in the last few years, I feel like. It is so rich and has none of like the...
And the cider or the perry?
The cider. The perry.
Yeah. Super, yeah.
It's so like astringent and delicious and like it still has that kind of like crazy celery thing and like cantaloupe juice quality that the cider has, but like... The tannin's really been cranked up, like, way higher than it's been in the past.
So up in the Finger Lakes, Black Duck and Eves and South Hill, they have, like, a secret treasure of old apple trees, don't they?
Yeah, well, what's amazing in the Finger Lakes is that, compared to the rest of New York State, like, Finger Lakes is not a traditional, like, large orchard-growing place. Like, if you're going to grow apple trees, you're going to make way more money and stuff growing apples on, like, Lake Ontario than the Finger Lakes, Hudson Valley. So the Finger Lakes orchard tradition comes out of a organic farming, sustainable farming background. So all these producers are farmers and organic producers first, and then also have to make cider.
But their apple operations and their orchards, are they organic? I mean, my understanding
maybe
is...
Maybe not organic per se, yeah. But they're all about... Like, the impetus of these producers are about this kind of... Most of these producers just mentioned are all about... like sustainable farming and things like that.
That sort of philosophy, not necessarily certification.
Right. And they're cider orchards that are grown for cider making rather than having to be like, I have a dessert culinary orchard in like Ontario that I'm trying to convert to make a value added product. So they're intentional cider producers because they're growing like weird varieties and like how else are you going to use all these weird varieties besides making cider?
The fruit up. Yeah. Totally.
So like it's a really unique spot in the entire country because of that. Like, tradition and dedication of organic and natural farming and like land stewardship that kind of emulates in the Finger Lakes that makes for some of the most like well-crafted and like for me like the best ciders in the country from the finger licks because they just do it right.
So, but what about the Perry then? So we're drinking something from pears.
This is pears. So this is John Morales' Perry. He grew these pears. He said he took 11 years to get a crop on these pears. And
do you know the varieties?
This is Brandy Butt Huff Cap. He grows like 5 varieties of pears. Mm-hmm. This is, I think, all Perry pears.
You're the only guy that knows it.
I know, this is amazing.
He usually throws in a bunch of suckle pears into his Perry as well. Usually like a third suckle. Although this has like way more tannin, so maybe there's less suckle than years past. Yeah. But it's a monster. John's a awesome curmudgeon-y, awesome guy. He's a first submit. He's also a curmudgeon-y yellow guy. And his ciders are funky and delicious, although they're getting less and less funky every year. And it being much more, as being the James Dean of cider world, he's not James Dean, James Brown of the cider world, he's much more like making cleaner cider, it seems like.
Hmm. How do you taste this? Like for me, this pops, it's tannic. I could drink this all night.
I could drink this all night too. I mean, and I, in general, like Perry's, and I'm glad to see, or like see a little bit more of them coming out of New York State. Mm. I mean, how does this strike me? Dan said it very well. This is incredibly tannic. I mean, like the astringency in my mouth right now is like totally blanked out. But it's still very drinkable. You could it's a slightly sweeter experience, I would say, than a cider. But yeah, I would be very happy with this and pretty
it's
much
like
any
sweet
context.
In the front, but then the mouth's like, yeah. Oh god, what the hell did you just do to me?
Yeah, you kind of have to just kind of like slap your tongue a little bit after.
Just chomping.
Any food pairing with this? Just drink it by itself.
It'd be really good with pork.
Yeah, pork is definitely the obvious answer here.
Yeah.
Or like root vegetables and things. Like Perry's really good for like root veggies or like fatty, even like
fatty
fish.
Something really fatty.
Yeah, like oily fish would be good. Like sardines or anchovies, something like that would be really good for this thing. Mm-hmm. Root veggies, carrots.
Getting hungry.
It's very like fall
well,
menu,
also,
right?
This type of beverage, like these type of ciders and perries that are dry, they really do stimulate your appetite. Like,
yeah,
we're
really
talking about food. I'm like, I do need some food.
Well, because the cider is so tannic that I'm just constantly salivating right now.
Yeah.
Just because how astringent it is in the palate. Just like, oh God, I need some like fat to like cleanse this out a little bit.
We better
pass this around and finish it.
Yeah.
So Dan, talk about Cider Week event. So you have a special event with Heritage Radio Network.
Yes. So on
October
26th, over at 100 Bogart, which is the new space down the street here, we're doing this amazing Newtown Pippin event, which is amazing. Newtown Pippin is New York City's like original apple, from, like the 1730s. It originates over in on an estate which is now Elmhurst, Queens.
Newtown Creek,
yeah. So Newtown Creek is where it comes from, most likely. And our space we're doing is right across Newtown Creek, so it's right near where it came from. We're basically, Newtown Pippin's an amazing apple because of the consistency across genetics, and that basically what we have today is basically universally the same apple across the country. So I think. And that it's the same apple that grows everywhere.
Isn't it also one of the few cider apples that you can kind of do a single varietal cider with?
Yes. So we have a bunch of single variety ciders we're bringing from this thing. It's a very popular apple to make cider with in California and places like that. There's not a whole lot actually grown in the Northeast. Like Steve Wood thinks this is not a very good cider apple, but it's it makes pretty good cider usually. And it's a cider variety that basically traveled across the country, and it was pretty planted across the country in the early 18th century. It goes down in like the 1790s. It travels down to Albemarle County, and it's like George Washington's supply master,
Virginia, right?
Yeah. Was from that area, and he brought the apple down to Albemarle County, and they call it Albemarle Pippin down there, but it's the same variety. And it's a pretty common variety throughout Virginia and in North Carolina. Yeah. And then it goes west over the Gold Rush, and it basically it's planted all throughout California and up into Oregon as a way to like feed people during the Gold Rush. It was a lot of miners who like gave up, like, I hate mining for gold. So they put orchards in kind of like feed the people who are hosting mining. So like in California, you have like Newtown Pippin and Yale Bellflower, the two varieties that were popular in the late 19th century. And they, that variety doesn't really exist anymore, but Newtown Pippin is still around in quantity, mostly because of Martinelli's. Martinelli's still buys it every year. It's the main variety they use in their pasteurized apple juice. Still Newtown Pippin. So me and Darlene Hayes, who's a retired biochemist from Sonoma County, she and I are doing this event over Heritage Radio. We're bringing around 25 different new Dunn Pippin apples from around the country, from like Michigan, New York, and New Hampshire, and Virginia, and North Carolina, and Washington. We're bringing them all together.
You're actually going to taste apples.
We're going to taste apples, and we're going to, Darlene's going to have them all measured out in terms of pHs and sugars and everything like that. And then we're going to have about a dozen ciders at the same time. Some of the ciders we have are going to be made from the apples from the same orchard we also have. And then we're going to taste all the ciders as well. And actually Ryan Burke from Angry Orchard's helping us with the tasting. He's going to kind of guide us through this like tasting that we're going to do with everybody. So we have around 12 ciders now that are around.
Can you name a couple of those cider producers?
So we have Tilted Shed has two ciders that we're bringing from two different orchards in Sonoma. We have Angry Orchard bringing some ciders. We have Kite and String, which mm-hmm. Good Life, which is not Kite and String cider, is bringing some. We're also getting some from Dragon Head Orchard up in Washington State. We're getting some from Diane Flint down in Virginia.
So this is really like a national thing. It's just really cool. Yeah, it's very different environments.
We did this event last year, kind of at Wassail, with Golden Russet apples. Mm. And it was me, Darlene, and Autumn from Eve Cidery did it. And we collected around 25 apples, and we collected around 12 ciders and did tasting with it. And what we ended up learning is that Golden Russet is actually not one variety, and that what we call Golden Russet is actually probably a collection of different apples, because it's a descriptive variety that doesn't really appear until like the 1840s. Mm. And people in the 1840s are like talking about old trees, and then no one before them are talking ever about old trees. So it's kind of like people had russeted golden apples at some point, and so like, well, yeah, this is a golden russet tree, rather than actually like
they use it more of like a descriptor than an actual name for a particular variety.
Yeah, but we talk about now in terms of as an actual variety. So like in our collection of like 25 apples we collected last year, we probably had around like 4 distinctive varieties, and our biggest difference was actually not where the apples came from, but actually where the orchard got their rootstock from, their budwood from, was actually the more important thing than anything else. We had like some pretty clear genetic traits, like the apples from Ian Merwin and Black Diamond Finger Lakes looked much more similar to like apples that from some mascot orchards, because they have the same rootstock or they have the same budwood origins, versus Eve's, whose apples look much more similar to Farnham Hills, because again, they're from the same, probably the same origin point. And that was our biggest thing. And like some of the guys in Colorado also just totally random varieties that like didn't look right at all. So,
So for you guys, what are people actually drinking? Because there's so many, you know, specialty, small, you know, cider makers that I love. A lot of them I met through you, but what are people actually drinking? You know, there's mass brands that we don't want to mention, but
people are drinking, go on.
Can't mention.
I mean, I guess to clarify your question a little bit, do you mean people are asking, or what are people drinking in terms of cider, or what are people drinking in general? Because I think we were talking a little bit before the show about the fact that, you know, where is cider drinking nowadays in general? So I don't know. I would ask you to clarify the question a bit.
I think you just did. So
so what do you think, Dan?
For people drinking in terms of cider, people are still experimenting with cider. Like it's, people are like unsure of cider in terms of like how it actually exists in their lifestyle, and like, we haven't quite figured out a way in the cider market to like get people to drink it every single day. Like, make it part of the routine. We were saying people like to like try a lot of ciders, and like, there's a lot of Nielsen data done last year on ciders, and like the result were that like people want to try a lot of cider. People are really about experimenting right now, not really brand devoted to ciders right now. So we're still like,
I feel that way too. I did a party this summer, and people went right. There was beer, cocktail, wine, and people drank that the way they drink those beverages. And then there was a small selection of 4 ciders. And everybody who went up to the cider table wanted to try all the ciders.
Yeah, it's like the data last year was like, people were very picky, not picky, but they're particular. And that with cider, they want to just kind of like, they're not loyal customers. They just kind of want to try like whatever they have. They want to try everything. They want to try cider for the sake of trying cider. And that's good, but at the same time, like, we don't, in the cider world, we don't have enough language vocabulary yet to really describe differences between ciders, that like we need to like have more of an education in terms of like what it actually means for us, rather than just like these things taste different. We need a little more like context than that.
Lauren, yeah. And Edible, have you guys written a lot about ciders?
So cider, I would say, ends up in at least every drink issue we do every year, which comes out annually. But I stuck it in the travel issue this year with Normandy. But we've done pieces that, you know, range from even just a primer on New York cider apples, so ones that are varieties from New York State that you see often in different things, which is how I had heard of New Town Pippin before. I feel like a lot of cider writing takes inspiration in many ways from wine writing. I think it's still figuring out its own distinctive voice that doesn't follow in line with that entire thing and that sort of history. But I mean, the reason when I moved to New York, the reason I got, you know, interested in cider was because there's so much of it. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there, but it generally is spoken about in a very similar way that wine is spoken about.
Yeah. Are there any events for Cider Week that you're looking forward to?
So I'm just now getting like sort of notifications in my inbox right now of different ones coming up. And so the one Dan referenced about New Town Pippin sounds like wonderfully nerdy to me. There was another one. I think it's just a media tasting, and I wasn't aware of this.
It's going to be a big one. It's media and everybody else.
No, a different one that's about, it's New York Ciders that won some international awards, I think.
Called like Hidden Stars, and it's on Wednesday at the Astra Center.
It's not just media. Maybe there's just a media
preview.
There's
a media preview for it.
Okay,
and there's going to be a media and trade preview, and there's going to be a
Wednesday,
bigger event.
Wednesday, October 25th.
Yeah, at the Astra Center. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be like our big event this year in terms of like our big tasting, our grand tasting with all the producers who are participating in Cider Week this year to kind of like go around and taste and try it with the ciders. We're going to have some talks and stuff.
So could you speak to though, like that sort of international competition and
so
how
yeah,
they performed?
I believe it was from the international, the Bath Cider Show, which is like the big cider show in the UK every year in the West Counties. And there's an exchange this year where a bunch of producers from New York State went over to England to kind of learn about cider making this year over in England. So like Autumn from Eves went, and Dan Wilson went, and I know David Fisher went, and Ryan Burke went, and Elizabeth Ryan went to kind of learn, Emma Singh some more as well, who all went to kind of learn about cider making this year. And they went to this show, their cider, and a bunch of them like won awards and placed awards in this English, American ciders won in the English cider show.
Wow.
So it was kind of like, hey, like, screw
you.
Is
that kind of like the first time that's happened?
I think it's the first time we've really like have tried to do it kind of thing. Like, we haven't done it before. So it was the first time per se, but it's definitely like for us, like it's a big thing. Like,
you got a toast to that, David.
Yeah.
Cheers.
I mean, my glass is empty. Is that bad?
It is bad. Dan's not a good, he's not a good palmier if your glass is empty.
Yeah. So it's a big deal. I think it's because a lot of the world is kind of looking to us right now as the United States in our market here, because we have this really fast and really growing cider market right now that the world's still trying to figure out. Like, the world is trying to figure out how to make cider make sense for them.
But I would say that's the same thing when I learned in Normandy, too. So Jerome, who came to Wassail and all these American cider makers were flocking to meet. I mean, if you look at a lot of his products, he does a lot of international research, I would say more so than most Normandy cider makers. A lot of his business is built around exports, but you know, 60-70% of his business is exports, and he's looking to see the ways that we're consuming alcohol in general so he can appropriate his cider to that. So he's making all sorts of stuff that is not in the traditional like Normandy canon to do that. So I would say, but he wants to target like markets like the US where we're open and interested in different things, because in France it's
pretty closed.
Yeah, it's pretty closed. As a younger generation just thinks it's an old person drink.
Yeah, no one
that's what I wanted you to say. That was in your article. I loved your article.
Yeah, that was in my piece.
No one drinks like outside of like rogue random things, no one drinks cider in France besides on vacation in Normandy.
Except on vacation in Normandy. Exactly. And then also Julian Frumont, which is another maker who I mentioned in my piece, he is starting to distribute. There is a place for, I feel like, certain ciders in the natural wine world in France, and he is starting to distribute in a lot of natural wine bars in Paris. So there is an opportunity there, but
yeah,
French tradition is not necessarily very open to new things.
No, it's the same thing in Spain, too. Like, Spanish market is also like pretty closed, and it's not like they drink a very traditional product, which is the Spanish Sidra, which is delicious and all that stuff, but like there's no market for that outside of the Basque Country or Asturias.
Cool. We'll be right back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Go Cider Week. Woo!
I don't go in for understanding when you are away. Can't use my heart to think away the...
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We got the country theme. You know, Lauren Wilson, you're from a farm in North Carolina, aren't you?
Let me get back to the microphone here. I'm trying to do two things. Pre-moving to New York, what got me interested in cider is that I grew up on a farm in North Carolina, and my farm is in transition right now between generations, and I'm interested and curious about ways we can evolve the business of the farm, and I'm interested in cider as a value-added product to take into the future. So I do have a personal interest here, too. Yeah.
Cool. And let's talk about what connection, natural wine, ciders, raw wine events. Keep talking about if that's what people are interested in. I do feel that the people that are younger, they want the natural wine, the same reason way that people are inspired by organic food as in general. I feel like they do want to drink better products.
Yeah. So I think like our
we don't really have a good labels, especially in cider.
Yeah, we have really bad vocabulary in cider. Like, we're really bad vocabulary on cider, and, like, I feel like the line between, like, really good cider that's made with great apples, that's fermented well and done everything properly, that line between those producers and the people who are doing things kind of half-assed is kind of really muddied. And it's not always easy in cider world to find, like, to kind of cut through some of that crap and, like, find things that are actually real and excellent for our
products.
But,
Dan, you seem to have a vocabulary for cider, like...
Yeah, but, like, that's not, like, it's not vocabulary cider that can actually, like... apply to, like, I don't think my vocabulary works well to, like, apply to, like, consumers to buy things.
Okay, let's do the Dan Pucci quiz. Dan, what is Esopus?
Esopus? It's a town up in the Hudson Valley. It's where
I could ask
Newtown Pippin
150 names of places and you would know that. No one in America would know.
But I think that more importantly, like, in terms of, like, natural wine stuff for cider, like well-made orchard-based ciders are excellent and they're low intervention, they're low tech, and like as the cider, as people want to drink like lower alcohol wines and everyone wants to drink like 11% like Sauvignon Blanc, 11% like Cab Franc, like what's more low alcohol than cider? Like the most ripest cider is 9%, and like most ciders around like 7% or so. It's like half of what wine's at. So like.
Dan, like what's Scion?
Scion or wood, basically it's a connection that goes on top of the thing.
So like when you're grafting?
When you're grafting, yeah.
That's very technical.
So you can ask them. This is the time. You can ask some crazy questions.
I don't know if that's necessarily our most interesting path we can go down. I mean, I think
just
I've...
for hours if you
yeah,
want to.
We could go for hours in that way. I feel like I get an education every time I talk to him.
I just feel like we can do like the cider community can latch on to these things in terms of them. Modern drink trends, and we can kind of relate better to our consumers in a way that shows that our products are real and have value to them. And
the media has a role to play here too. I mean, like there's being, you know, a publication that talks about New York State and what's going on in the city in particular, you know, we'd be remiss to not be talking about cider, but I feel like it's part of a national conversation. You know, there's the once every 6 months piece in the Times that kind of has to do about cider, but it's not necessarily risen to the level of wanting to have consistent national coverage. And we could look at the wine history. I don't want to like put it too much in the wine box, but what needs to happen to elevate that? I don't know.
What I was talking about on top of this is that, I always look to a really interesting name of this is, Frank Schumacher, who is a like 1930s, 1920s, 40s, importer of wine here in New York, and he basically is the guy who basically got varieties on wine labels. Basically, what was going on is that prior to that, and still you can find that today in California, people were labeling wines like Chablis or like Mountain Burgundy or like semi or like
so the region as opposed to like what the composition.
But it wasn't like it was not a region because like it's in California. They're calling like California Chablis.
Oh,
and I have like California Chablis, California Rhine wine, and California like Sauternes. They're all probably basically the same grape varieties, but they like the idea was that like my Chablis was kind of like light and dry, and the Moselle was like a little light and sweet, and the Sauternes was like fuller bodied and kind of sweet. And like there were more about kind of ideas of what you thought cider, what the wine should taste like, rather than anything actually real. So like what happened was like customers.
So anything like it was less specific. It was a more general way of talking about it as opposed to very specific.
Right. So customers would like would buy this producer X's Chablis, and they're like, oh, this is kind of nice. And they'd buy producer Y Chablis and be like, what the hell is this? This is nothing at all like that wine over there. Mm-hmm. And so it like it really kind of skewed people's expectations of what beverages what the wine should have tasted like. So I think that like while variety is maybe not the best answer for cider, because like most ciders are blends of different varieties and things like that, but like having that attention towards variety is an important way that we can kind of like get more detail into the cider community and into the cider market and kind of learn more about like why I like X versus Y. It's because it has Ashman's Kernel in it and Golden Russet, and this one we hear has Yarling Tamil in it, and it's like I like Yarlington Mill. It's a really nice apple, and it makes this flavor. It's like, well, but maybe not only that flavor, but other flavors too. So I think like, that's kind of the way we need to go forward with the cider community.
And then other things, labels, like for many years, some of the top, I call them the top grower cider makers, were trying to get behind the idea of American fine cider movement.
Yeah.
And now I think I'd like to wrap up and talk about how ciders can be grouped with natural wines in that category. Do you think that's the way to get more sophisticated palates interested in cider?
I mean, it's a gateway, but I wouldn't want to stop there necessarily. I think I think we're doing cider a disservice if we want to grow it, like the interest in it, to really just kind of always put it in the wine category. I know that when I talked to Dan about some of the Normandy ciders that I tried, there was, in general, one of the lines you gave me was like, in general, you could compare the traditional Normandy style to like a Petit Naturel wine, you know, that's like,
bubbly and fresh.
Yeah, exactly. So in any case, I think that's a good entryway, but I feel like it doesn't need to stay there. I think it needs to evolve if we want to really like create a cider.
We need to have like an actual
identity.
We need to grow on other people's movements, like put in a craft beer did and natural wine, things like that. But like we need to like grow cider as a thing.
So you're my consultant. We're opening a great little wine bar in Bushwick, maybe the backyard of Roberta's. And I, you know, I've got some wine, I got some cocktails, I got some beer. I want to have four ciders. We're going to go all out. We're not just going to have one cider. We want four ciders. What do you think would go well here at Roberta's?
Here at Roberta's, I think the Black Duck we just had would be great here. Yeah. That stuff's awesome. And
with a really cheesy pizza.
Cheesy pizza would be great for it. Yeah. Then I would do Eve's up in the Finger Lakes too, because her cider is so good and so like perfect and everything I want to drink possible.
She's my favorite in New York State.
Yeah, her ciders are, oh my God, they're so good. And then I think I'd be really curious. I know Farnham Hill has a brand new, they're making like a brand new kind of cheaper cider this year. I think that'd be really interesting to have too, because it's like kind of has some bittersweet quality to it, but not quite so much so. It hasn't tried it yet, but Steve Tillman's is really good. Then I would finally do like Snowdrift's Red Cider, which is the most fun cider because it's Snowdrift's out in Washington State, and they use this like crazy.
What's it called? Snowdrift. Snowdrift.
He's out in Wenatchee, Washington. I was out there like 2 weeks ago or so. I visited him, and his ciders are excellent and so fantastic. And he makes this a crazy like red flesh cider. It's made from this like formerly wild Kazakh variety that got imported for some reason. He now has access to the fruit.
It's like some deep history stuff.
It's pretty weird. He has someone grows his apples for him, and he makes this cider out of it. And it's like he's all grower producer except for this one cider he makes, which is the red cider. Mm. And it's his best selling cider because it's bright red and tastes bright red. It's like tastes like cranberry juice and berries, and it kind of like challenges what you think cider can be because it's like kind of dry and like really tart and really tart and like tastes red and it's not like fruity at all. It's cool.
Dan, I'm happy that you stumbled into Wassail and got that job, because you've opened a lot of doors for all of us, and so many great producers came in to see you. And then this is a Pomo.
Yeah.
Lauren, you brought this?
Yeah. So this is interesting because, so I was visiting the Finger Lakes. I was at the Finger Lakes Cider House a few months ago. I guess it was in the earlier summer. And Pomo is a drink I actually encountered in Normandy. I had never seen it in the U.S., but I was at the Finger Lakes Cider House and saw it for sale there, and I was like, okay, I have to try this. What is Pomo? Pomo is a liqueur that is essentially like what you... It's apple juice in Normandy that's been added to Calvados, which is the apple brandy that's also iconic of like the Normandy region. There's several New York makers who are doing it. I don't think very many people are aware of what it is, and for that reason, they don't buy it. So,
yes.
Do you want to, Dan? I reached out to you recently because I had a writer do a piece on Pomo for our holiday issue. So, do you want to speak to what Pomo is in New York State?
Yeah, so Pomo in New York State is the growing category. Most people kind of make it as kind of like a sweet beverage to have because it's a little more easier to make, but it's a little more concentrated and simpler to make than like ice cider, which is a really hard thing to make. So it adds something kind of sweet to their portfolio naturally. So like I said, it's fortified cider basically. Mm-hmm. And there's some
16-17%.
Yeah. And there's some really excellent ones here made in New York State. Like this one's excellent from Good Life. Their new bottling under Kentering labeling is awesome because it's actually made from ice cider juice.
Oh, wow.
So it's like, what it's like add concentrated
their brandy.
And then they brandy that up. So it's like super sweet. And like it's like 40 grams per liter sweet with the acid and the stuff. It's really awesome. And then also Finger Lakes, you have South Hill and Black Diamond, which both make excellent Pomo. And then the most serious Pomo maker is probably actually Orchard Hill. Carl DeHoffman at Orchard Hill makes like... I've had some of his like Pomo, he's been doing it for like 7 years now, and some of Pomo is like, it's still in barrel for like 7 years, and it's like, it's pretty cool, and it's got some really interesting like concentration and flavor to it and stuff after all those years.
I'm a fan of Pomo.
Yeah, like, well, can we also, for people who maybe never heard of Pomo, is to give a little bit of like, how would you drink Pomo traditionally?
It's an after dinner drink.
Yeah, I think so.
They also drink it as like, I've heard of it, like, it's an aperitif, but like, no one drinks aperitifs ever, and then, like, no one definitely drinks, like, sweet aperitifs.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, it's also good in cocktails and things like that. Like, I like using it.
I have a good... For many years at Jimmy's Number 43, before I had a liquor license, you know, people would be drinking beer all night. And on the way out, I would have the Domaine DuPont Pomo. They had a little cask that I would put at the end of the bar, and I would give little taste of it to the customers
great.
On the way out.
I'd love to know that.
So the whole point is that it is great. Yeah, after you've had your beer or your cider, you want something sweeter and stronger on the way out the door.
Yeah.
It's definitely that drink. In fact, let's have some more now. We can close it out. That was one more question, Lauren. You're really great. I'm going to have to bring you back for another Cider Week show.
I have to go somewhere else in the world and write about cider.
But we have coming up, so the big event, Heritage Radio Network with Dan Pucci. Darlene Hayes, our good buddy.
Yeah.
October 26th. And I believe the tickets are on heritageradionetwork.org.
They are indeed, yeah.
They just went live today.
Yeah. Live today, yeah.
Our show, it's October 24th, the live Beer Sessions radio show will be with about still ciders. We're talking about a particular type of cider, which we don't think about as much, with Steve Salen from South Hill and Maria Kennedy, who's a great Cornell educated, you know, expert.
Mm-hmm.
That week, October 28th, Cider Feast at Brooklyn Kitchen with about 15 producers. Kind of like the one Dan's doing at Hunter, but it's in New York City.
Cider in the Mountains. So it's all it's a very nice new bluestone patio. We're going to look overlooking the valley. It's going to be pretty cool.
But also another shout out. We got a lot of shout outs. Rye Week's coming up. There's so many New York things inspired by, you know, New York rye. Now 9 New York distillers have come together and they've made a Empire State Rye Whiskey, and that's October 18th to 22nd at New York Distilling. Check it out, ryeweek.com. And also for beer, hey, it's still Beer Sessions Radio. October 14th, New York City Brewers Guild, Blocktoberfest. There's so many great breweries in New York City. In fact, over 30. They'll all be at the Well on October 14th. So, Dan, once again, thanks for coming on.
Oh, of course.
Yeah,
it's great.
And what should I drink tonight after this?
More beer, probably.
There's so many great new cideries coming up.
Sorry.
Always drink cider. Always be drinking cider.
Well, you want to taste cider. That's all.
Always drink cider.
But thanks for coming on, guys. Dan and Lauren, I'd like to thank our sponsors at Union Beer Distributors. have helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. Thanks to our producer, Justin Kennedy, engineer extraordinaire, David Tatasciore, and thanks for listening. See you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Woo. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.